Welcome to the Philosophy of Now podcast from Roots Media. Today's guest and her research couldn't be more relevant. She is a psychologist, a researcher, and professor of applied psychology at NYU's Steinhardt School of Culture, Development, and Education. Her research has consistently sought to understand the relationship between racial differences and prejudice and its impact on children's learning skills and mental health. Her studies look into a wide range of students, from adolescents to college students, seeking to understand the impact of racism on socio-emotional developments of different students. During a time where the world faces a pandemic, schools reopening, especially the Black Lives Matter revolution sparking positive change in our workplaces and schools, we have with us Dr. Diane Hughes. So I wanted to kick things off by asking you about your journey itself. How did you start off getting into the study of prejudice and racism in classrooms and in workspaces, studying children, adolescents, and students, and how they face racism and how that may affect them? What really got you into studying this?
Well, I think I've always been inclined towards issues around social justice. I'm not quite sure why, but I've been that way since I was in high school, really. I went to a very progressive high school in Philadelphia. It was a Quaker school, very much, you know, Philadelphia, number one, is the city that has experienced historically a lot of fairly progressive change around social justice. It's one of the first cities that basically had no slavery, right? It's where freedmen could actually go. I grew up in a very integrated community, also where there was not a lot of, I'm not going to say there was no racial stratification, but there was less than you would typically find. It was, you know, I mean, in the part of the city that I grew up in. I mean, there's a lot of poverty in Philadelphia. There's a lot of concentrated poverty in Philadelphia. But in West Mount Airy, where I grew up, their schools are integrated. And there were a lot of very high achieving Black students in the school that I went to. And there were a lot of high achieving white students, and there were a lot of not high achieving Black and white students. So there wasn't the kind of stratification that you actually see. And in growing up, my father in particular really emphasized his family history, even though it was my mother's family history that included a lot of social activism on the part of both of her parents. But I can't really pinpoint how that translated into my own interest.
Okay.
So I went to a fairly elite college where for the first time, I think I experienced my Blackness in a way that I had not when I was in high school. Because I encountered a lot of very wealthy white students that had grown up in very separate and segregated environments, and they hadn't had a lot of contact. I went to college during a time where a lot of students who, students of color, and that was mainly Black students at the time, were on financial aid. And so my father was actually a physician. I was not on financial aid, but there was always an assumption that I was on financial aid, an assumption that I had gotten admitted to the college through some kind of affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And I encountered that all constantly. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. I come from the same kind of background you do. Like, I'm not, you know, I don't need your old clothes, right? And so that kind of thing. And I think that kind of reinforced my initial interest. But even when I was in high school, I did a lot of work in high poverty neighborhoods. My school had something called a Quaker work camp, where you basically went somewhere and did service work for an entire summer. And I did that when I was in high school. So by the time I got to, you know, graduate school, I think I became aware of how ethnocentric the knowledge base in social science was about certain things that mm-hmm. hadn't considered other histories besides white American history. Right. So I was working with a very prolific writer in the area of maternal employment. Her name was Lois Hoffman. And she basically spearheaded that entire area of research on what happens to kids when their mothers are in the workforce. And I'm thinking to myself, my mom wasn't in the workforce, but historically Black women have always been in the workforce. So, mm-hmm. you know, why is this such an issue now that white women are entering the workforce? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I started. Like, how do we reframe this problem in a way that takes into consideration different cultural histories and not just white upper middle class families' cultural histories? And that's kind of how I got to where I was. So it's a surprising sort of transition, but I was studying race in that context. And there was a lot of work on how fathers in particular, fathers' occupational roles were influencing their parenting, because they come to value the skills and traits that are valued in their workplace, right? Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking, well, yeah, that's right, because Black fathers, especially when they start to experience discrimination in the workplace, come to believe it's important to teach their children in certain ways about race. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I got into the whole area of racial socialization, how parents teach race, how kids learn it. And then it almost naturally expands from there, right? Like, what are kids' experiences of race? That right. obviously includes discrimination. How do they develop a positive identity in the context in which they're racial group is devalued, right? I started out thinking about African Americans, but there are a lot of other groups in the US who are stereotyped and devalued and discriminated against in a lot of ways, almost every non-white group, actually. Mm-hmm. Jewish families also talk a lot about their history of discrimination and current experiences of discrimination in certain parts of the country. So that's how I kind of expanded my interest.
That's interesting. I wanted to ask you about one of your more recent research studies on college students and racism they face.
The recent study with Juan del Toro?
Yes, that's the one. Mm-hmm. That's the one. Okay. In regards to that, what was the journey of coming up with that study? What did you guys end up finding out? What were the results?
That was an interesting study because I didn't actually collect that data. So that data was secondary. It was an analysis of data that's publicly available. And it was collected by researchers at Princeton. And the reason that it was so interesting to us, number one, was because it was a large data set. And it was not a lot of studies of college students are at a single university. This one was at 28 colleges and universities across the U.S. And there were large samples of multiple ethnic groups. And they ask about kids' discrimination experiences, not in an in-depth way, but they ask about it every year that they were in college. And they ask about their adjustment every year. So they followed these kids from the time they entered college through the time they actually graduated from college, which is really interesting, and it was an unusual data set. So basically what we found was that students, I mean, I should, probably should pull up the paper because it was a while ago, that students who experienced discrimination, more discrimination initially, were over time less likely to feel like they belonged at the in their college environment. And the prevalence of discrimination was incredibly high, especially for Black students. Almost all of them experienced at least some, not a lot, but at least some discrimination. One of the things that we find in our work is that students report, you know, both college students and early adolescents report relatively infrequent discrimination, but even these very low levels of discrimination have noticeable effects on their well-being when you study it over time. So, you know, initially when we started to work in this area, the responses that we would get from, you know, reviewers of our work would be like, well, but the rates of discrimination are so low. And it's like, yeah, they are low. And that's what makes it so powerful, that they're actually related to graduation rates. They're related to other indicators of adjustment. They're related to feelings of psychological well-being. Right. They're related to health symptomatology. So, you know, I think that's finding that's beginning to grow in the literature. Like, nobody finds, you know, incredibly high and very frequent rates of discrimination, but almost everyone finds that it's related to poor adjustment outcomes.
So in your studies, how would you determine what is like low discrimination or high discrimination? Like, what determines that? What are your criteria?
If you measure it on it, so it depends on how people measure it in lots of different ways, right? So one of the ways that, so we have an 18 item index that we ask students a lot of different questions about, you know, in the past, you know, year, how often have people acted as if they're afraid of you because of your race, right? And one would be never, and five would be very often, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can do one of two things with that. Either you can take the average of people's responses across all items. And I would say a low level would be, so it's never, rarely, sometimes, often, very often. And it's usually between rarely and sometimes where you see the action. Like, kids aren't saying it never happens, right? So that's one way, is just take the average. And a second way would be to look across all the 18 items and see how many of them ever happened, ever at all, right? And so, you know, 4 or 5 out of 18 would also be a place where there's a lot of action.
I see. Even in terms of, though, adolescents, like, you have also studied younger children and their responses to prejudice and how it's affected them throughout the years. I believe, like, it's also done by tracking them over multiple years and seeing how they've changed or how they've developed due to discrimination, socio-emotional circumstances. What were the results that you saw there?
So we did with a different sample, not this college sample, but a sample of kids that we followed from the time they entered sixth grade through 11th grade. Number one, we found that kids increasingly report discrimination between sixth and eighth grade. So they're reporting as they get deeper into adolescence, right? When they're in sixth grade, they're 11, 12. When they're in eighth grade, they're 14, 15. the if you ask them yearly, right, these questions, that the frequency with which they're just experiencing discrimination is increasing over the course of adolescence. Mm-hmm. There could be a number of reasons that's happening, which I could talk about if you want. But basically, for kids whose experiences with discrimination are increasing over time, we found, this is a study that's published in Developmental Psychology, I think, which is one of, you know, a pretty big journal in my field. Kids who experience increasing discrimination basically report, you know, lower grades, less engagement in school, less belief, efficacy, belief that they can do well in school in eighth grade. Right. So by the time they're, if you follow them from sixth to eighth grade, kids who are on that increasing trajectory are looking worse in terms of both their psychological well-being and in terms of their academic engagement and adjustment and performance and things like that. There's a study that I cite a lot because it's so fascinating. A woman named Jackie Eccles did a relatively large study of adolescents in Maryland in the 90s, early 90s, a longitudinal study of Black and white adolescents. And another group of scholars got a grant to follow those kids up later on. Mm-hmm. And there's a paper written by, the first author is Emma Adam, and I'm not sure who the rest of the authors are, but basically they were able to look at the discrimination that adolescents reported when they were, you know, 11, 12, during early adolescence. And they followed them for multiple years. I don't remember offhand which years it was, but multiple times through adolescence, they asked them about their discrimination experiences. And then when they were early adults in their mid-20s, they took biological measures like cortisol patterns and things like that. And what they found was that kids who had experienced more discrimination cumulatively during adolescence had disrupted cortisol patterns as adults.
Wow.
Which is really, really powerful finding. The thing is that it's not just one thing, you know. It's not like discrimination has negative consequences for one thing, like depression or psychological well-being. It's everything: disrupted sleep, lower academic performance, lower academic engagement. Like almost any, like if you look at the literature as a whole, it's a huge range of things for which there's demonstrated negative consequences.
Also, in terms of the way you guys track and the way you guys study, what do you use to really determine, what are the tools you really use to determine that the discrimination is actually creating an impact, that it's actually causing negative impacts on an individual?
What's the mechanism? Right. So there's some work on that, right? What are the mechanisms through which discrimination has its effects? And some of it has been done by, you know, people working in the area of stereotype threat and other types of discrimination. So one hypothesis is that, just biological processes, right? Mm-hmm. Like the short-term effects on, cortisol release and things like that has a disruptive, mm-hmm. biological sequelae. Another is basically that there are cognitive resources that are taken up in processing discrimination that then are not available to put to more productive use because it's, you know, you're kind of ruminating and processing negative discrimination experiences. Right. So those are the, a third is just sort of a feeling of efficacy, like that experiencing discrimination. So for academic adjustment, for example, experiencing discrimination causes a belief, right, that you're gonna have less opportunity because of your social category membership, and then you you disinvest in that area because you don't believe that you're going to have an opportunity in that area anyway. So those kinds of things, yeah.
So how are you actually able to conclude that this is causation and not just correlation? Because that error is probably very likely in any study, right? So how are you able to rule that out?
That's a good question, because there are a number of issues in the way that discrimination actually is studied.
Correct.
So one issue is that it's all self-report, right? And so, like, how do you know that something else is not both causing kids to report more discrimination, regardless of what they experience, right, and causing them to report lower academic adjustment, right? That's called the third variable problem. So there's some work. Well, so in our work, typically when you're looking at within individual change, a little hard to explain. So you're looking at changes within individuals. Okay. You kind of are eliminating personality factors as a possible
explanation,
alternative explanation for your findings, because you're kind of controlling for those by looking within the person.
Gotcha.
So that's one way. I'm sure that there are, although I can't think of one right now, but I'm sure there are, even with adolescents, experimental studies. I can't think of one. I mean, I guess there are ethical issues in intentionally exposing kids to negative stimuli, but I'm sure like, I'm not a experimental social psychologist, so that's not a method that I would necessarily use first.
Okay.
But there probably are experimental studies that have manipulated that, and so with experimental work, it's way, you know, you're ruling out all everything. You know, you have an experimental condition and a control condition, and the thing that differs between those two conditions is the discrimination, say.
Right.
So that's another way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was also curious to know if you've seen differences in parenting skills based on parents of children who have faced discrimination or who are marginalized and those who are at a higher upper middle class or a white majority. Are parenting skills different? How are they different?
Andrew Fellini has a paper on that that I just looked at, where he finds that mothers' discrimination, I believe, is associated with kids' distress in some way, but I don't remember the details of it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of work. You know, if you think of discrimination as being one indicator of a stressor, there's a lot, you know, which it actually is. So when it's chronic, right, it's like any other stressor. And there's a lot of evidence that women who are exposed to chronic stressors, right, are less emotionally available in their parenting. Another way is, you know, that parents who experience more discrimination actually incorporate teachings about discrimination into their parenting, yeah, right? So those would be the ways, like just less emotional availability, probably less maternal warmth, things like that is what I would guess.
Right. I also wonder how you feel, considering today's climate, with the Black Lives Matter movement getting the much needed revolution post George Floyd's murder, as well as the debate over schools reopening across the nation with the digital divide and the potential socioeconomic divide that will play a big dramatic role in it. Do you feel like your work and your research is more relevant than ever?
Well, it raises just a lot of questions. So I think the Black Lives Matter movement and George Floyd, I mean, it's fascinating to me, like, why this, you know, because it was so public. Mm-hmm. And Black men have been getting killed by the police forever, you know, for centuries, for generations they have. And so why now? You know, why did this one? And it was just so visible in ways that people couldn't tolerate. And so the question, you know, what one of the things that we've consistently found in our work is that white parents are very reluctant to talk to their kids about race. And so that's one of the big things that I would expect to change, is that many, many more kinds of families are having conversations with their kids potentially about privilege.
Right.
And about injustice and about racism and oppression. How long that will, you know, and with the potential for having a, you know, female, Black, Indian vice president, I think these conversations about race will continue to happen. But the you know, one of the things that I think has been just a challenge for ethnic racial minority families is that, you know, who are raising kids is that, well, really all families, kids are seeing, you know, kids see racial disparity all over the place.
Sure.
You know, like every space they go is segregated. Like that's a Black church, that's a white church, right? My parents' friends are, you know, coming over for dinner and they look just like us. And those families have different kinds of dinners and, you know, this is a Black neighborhood, this is where the Black kids go and this is a white neighborhood, yeah, right? They see this.
Right.
And they also see economic disparities, because when you go into a Black neighborhood, it's typically high poverty or immigrant, like any kind of immigrant neighborhood, it's more likely to be a high poverty neighborhood. So they come to associate skin color with these things, crime, trash, neighborhood quality, right?
Right.
So they're learning race in those ways, but the narrative in our country is that race doesn't matter.
Right.
Right? Race doesn't matter. We're a colorblind society. Mm-hmm. Everyone's equal. We value diversity. Everyone has the same opportunity, yet they see this, these other things, and no one's talking to them about it. So then they come to these conclusions about, you know, it perpetuates itself. They come to conclusions that have to do with the inner resources of people who are living in this neighborhood and not about things like structural racism.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
Piggybacking off that question, though, with us and society becoming more and more aware of systemic racism and becoming more conscious of the reality of it in a lot of parts of society, how much of systemic issues related to racism are due to actual socioeconomic problems, and how much of it is actually due to pure racism? If that makes sense.
So, you know, that's hard, so hard to untangle in this society because they're so, we call them confounded. They're just so intertwined. But the reality is that if you take something like the academic achievement gap, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, are you familiar with that term?
I get those terms by themselves, but not together. Yeah.
So the achievement gap is a term that educators and researchers use to refer to the persistent racial gap in any indicator of achievement. So it could be grades, could be test scores, could be college graduation rates, it could be college entrance exam, you know, anything you look at. There's a fairly large achievement gap between white students, right? Say they're here, and African American and Latinx students, right? So it would be Latinx students, African-American students, and then typically, quote unquote, Asian students, not all, but right. from some groups are, you know, higher, a little bit higher than white students. So that's mm-hmm. what we refer to as the racial achievement gap. If you look at kids in the same school, right, the achievement gap exists. If you look at same community, same school. If you look at kids in the middle class or the upper middle class, the achievement gap exists. If you look at reports of discrimination, right, it exists at all levels of the occupational structure. So it's not only happening among, you know, lower, what I'm trying to, low, like they call them, you know, upper primary. So those would be like professionals, right? Upper primary workers, lower primary workers would be like kind of blue and pink collar workers, and then secondary workers. That's how, right? The discrimination, the reports of discrimination, the differences in income compensation occur at all levels, right?
Right.
Of all, you know, look at Black graduates from Harvard, look at white graduates from Harvard, you're going to see a disparity.
Okay.
So it's not pure, a lot of it is economic, and it's a more palatable way to kind of explain the experience of people of color yeah. in the US. You know, it's kind of like, well, that's all poverty. It's not racism.
Right.
But, you know, there was a really interesting paper that got a lot of press recently by Sean Reardon, who uses like big data to look at things like mobility. And he basically found, you know, downward mobility among Black kids who had grown up in upper middle class neighborhoods, right? So it's happening at all throughout the socioeconomic structure.
I see. Also, in regards to adolescents, though, how much of their prejudice and their racism comes from their influences and their environment, whether it be family, friends, peers, and how much of it is coming from them naturally? According to your research and understanding, what I'm basically asking is, how much of racism and prejudice is innate in a human at a young age, and how much of it is influenced by their circumstances and their environment?
Their willingness to discriminate?
Yeah.
Yeah, so interestingly, studies don't find a huge correlation between parents' attitudes and the racial attitudes of parents and racial attitudes of their kids. I mean, some of it is because, you know, there's some of it is because that there's a lot of what we call social desirability in asking questions about racial attitudes. So how to really truly get at it is difficult. And have you heard of the IAT, the implicit attitudes test? You can take it online, actually.
Okay.
This is a method of measuring implicit attitudes, racial bias that you're not aware of. So it's unconscious attitudes that Marzu Banaje, who was at Yale, then she was at Michigan, I don't know where she is now, developed years ago. And there's a ton of work on it. You can go online and yeah. take it yourself and see how see how biased you actually are. So some of the kind of correlation, low correlation, is due to people not being willing to admit. But my position is that, you know, there's a natural tendency to prefer people who look like you, right? There's and to prefer people in powerful positions, right? So if you're white, there's just a natural tendency to prefer your own group. If you're Black, you know, there's just been there's a whole history of research on this, like the doll studies and stuff like that. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're racial preference tasks, basically. So you ask a kid, you know, here's a black doll, here's a white doll, classic study, which one is dirty, which one is nice, right. Which one mean, like, right. And white kids almost always prefer white kids, black kids also prefer white kids because they're from the dominant group until they get older, basically. Yeah. It is a process that I think has to be intentionally disrupted. That's my position on prejudice and racism in kids, that you have to intentionally disrupt it. There was a episode of CNN, I can't remember, I have it on my computer, but they did a really interesting show where they brought teenagers in with their parents, mm-hmm. and they had and the teenagers were assigned to do a group task, right? So the task could be pick someone to be on your debate team, or it could be pick someone who's going to be the all-American teen idol, right? So they had to do this. They had to do it in groups, and they planted teenagers in the group that were supposed to sway the group to be act in a discriminatory manner, right? Yeah. None of the parents thought, and the parents were watching, right? None of the parents, and all the kids kind of went with the discriminatory lead, right? They kind of were afraid not to speak up about it, to disrupt the group process, right? And so, for example, they had a spelling bee, and the task was to choose somebody for your team, and the black kid in the spelling bee and a white kid in the spelling bee made the exact same number of errors, right? Mm-hmm. The exact same number of errors, got the exact same number of things right, and the two Confederates on the team were like, yeah, but he just doesn't seem that intellectual to me. He just doesn't seem like he's going to help us that much, right? They were intentionally doing this. Yeah. And, you know, basically the rest of the group ultimately complied and picked the white person, right? And the parents were in shock. They were like, I never thought my child would do that. I always thought my child would speak up for themselves. But anyway, you know, I think kids have to be taught to intentionally disrupt that. Yeah. And if it's not intentional, if parents aren't deliberately doing, you know, teaching kids how to reinterpret, interrupt, dispel stereotypes, then there's almost a natural inclination for prejudice and discrimination to happen. And actually another important thing. So in our work, we differentiate between discrimination from a peer, discrimination from an adult in school, discrimination from an adult outside of school. We also did that in the National Longitudinal Survey of Freshmen. Right. And kids report, most of the discrimination they report is from peers.
Wow. That's crazy, and yet that is believable, you know? Subtly I feel certain individuals may just naturally think and act in such a way, and it wouldn't be, it may be shocking to people who are close to them, but it just comes out, you know? But moving on to that, you know, mental health being such a big issue amongst youngsters today, has there been any correlation or research related to how racism and prejudice or any sort of discrimination against youngsters and adolescents impacts them in terms of depression or anxiety or any other mental health issue in the future?
Yeah, so there's a lot of, there are a fair number of studies actually that link reports of discrimination to depression, mm-hmm. reports of discrimination to anxiety, to lack of belongingness, you know, things like that.
Moving on to something that is a little more relevant, what are your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement getting such a big revolution post the death of George Floyd, as well as the recent murder of Jacob Blake, you know, people taking it a lot more seriously. How do you think this will impact the way we see discrimination and racism in the workforce, in schools?
Okay, so the my hope about the norm, I alluded to it a little bit, is that, you know, race has been one of those things that people are terrified to talk about, especially white people. You know, they're terrified to talk about it. I mean, they just do not talk about it. And they don't, you know, talk about seeing racial difference. They don't, you know, and hopefully this will open up a dialogue about race in this country that makes it more normative to talk about it. And, you know, you have a lot of institutional level programming and policy shifts that are intended to open up conversations about diversity, about equity, and about justice. So it's coming both from the bottom up and it's coming from the top down. And I think increasing dialogue also increases awareness and sensitivity and acknowledgement of, you know, inequality and injustice. So that's my hope in terms of norms.
And the second thing we kind of touched on as well is the fact that schools are debating how they'll reopen, right? A lot of schools have already reopened. Some colleges have, and they're already facing cases within the first weeks. A lot of schools are going virtually. How do you think race differences and socioeconomic differences based on racial groups and prejudices and systemic racism, as we call it, how do you think that will affect, or how do you think that will be a part of the way schools are reopening? Do you think those that are, you know, do you think certain races may be impacted more negatively than other ones just based on whether we call it the digital divide or the ways certain school and educational resources are divided amongst different racial and ethnic groups? How do you see this playing out?
You know, COVID is magnifying the disparities that already exist, right? So they're magnifying the health disparities. In so many ways, right? So the underlying health disparities that already existed in this country mean that Black and Brown people are way more likely to get sick and die from COVID than whites are. So we already know that. So there's that disparity. There's also the fact that, you know, they're more likely to be in these service jobs that had to continue during COVID. Like, you know, I'm sitting at home getting paid, working on my computer. All my friends are too, you know, people in professional jobs, their lives just go on. They might feel a little bit isolated. People in service jobs had to work, you know, I mean, they're in stores behind cashier registers, picking up garbage, you know, they're working. So there's that disparity.
Right.
While they're working, their kids are not in school. So what are they doing about that? You know, how are they managing their job and having kids home from school? Kids are home from school and don't have access to technology, right? Be able to get the, or supervision, or space to actually sit down at a, they don't even have a computer, you know, let alone space to sit with a computer and learn. I mean, it's just exacerbating all of these disparities that already existed. So yeah, it's very, very, very worrisome. Very worrisome.
Speaking of what's relevant to the youth, based on your studies and based on your interactions, what do you think is the most pressing issue that the modern youth, the next generation, faces?
I mean, the things that I worry about the most for my grandchildren are, I worry about terrorism, right? I don't study that, but I worry about sort of this culture of, you know, mass shootings and violence and terrorism and stuff like that. I'm hopeful about intergroup relations actually for them, because I think they're growing up. I mean, kids who are kids in my community, which is, you know, an integrated community, but they're, you know, they're seeing Black Lives Matter signs all, you know, painted in the street and in on everybody's property, you know, so they're, so I'm a little bit hopeful that the national conversations that we have, you know, and they're also seeing, we just had a Black president. Now we're going to hopefully have a Black vice president or a person of color. So they're seeing, you know, my hope is that they'll see that your category membership, whether it's race or gender or, you know, gender identity, you know, whatever, doesn't really define your future. That's my hope.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was very inspiring. And I do hope that what you're saying does come true, that we become a more self-aware and conscious society.
Right.
Thank you once again.
Thank you.
For more content like this, follow the Philosophy of Now podcast and check out rootsmedia.org.